Hello, you're listening to The Joys of Teaching Literature. We're talking about how to make your life easier, less stressful, more fun, more meaningful for your students, for you. This week we're going to talk about literary techniques. If you want to know more about me, I have a website, theteachersworkshop.com. I offer online professional development for high school English teachers. I also have a Teachers Pay Teacher store. So if you want to sort of check that out, you can do that. Also, if you're listening and like my podcast, please give me a review wherever you get your podcast. So this week we're talking about probably one of the most important. I do always say that's the beginning. This is so important. I try to pick topics that are obviously important for what we do, but literary techniques are, you know, that's what makes English English, right? And what makes literature literature. It's where the term literature comes from. So that there's literary techniques and devices present in the in everything that we do. I think I dabbled in this throughout my life in high school and college. I think when I got to teach AP literature, it became something where I was sort of concerned with how to teach it and what techniques. Like, you know, I think it was really when you think about all of the techniques that are out there, there's this, I mean, it almost seems infinite. There's just so many. And it can be overwhelming, right? So I think how to teach literary devices is something that I cover in the course that I offer. And I'll show you the PowerPoints that I give, and there's different sort of moments in the year where I sort of pause, and usually it's pretty early in the year just to set up that foundation, make sure everybody knows the different, you know, sort of academic vocabulary of what we do. If you think about it, there's terms associated with narrative, you know, who's telling the story, and you know, techniques like the foil, or even epic tragedy, comedy, archetype, tension, conflict, juxtaposition, allegory, parable, fable. You know, irony, I think, is something for narratives, foreshadowing, that sort of thing. Then there's who is the narrator. So there's a narrative or the story, but then there's who's telling the story. And you have things like stream of consciousness, free and direct discourse, third-person objective, omniscient narration, epistolary, unreliable narrator, right? All these different terms that students have to get familiar with, especially when you're bouncing around between different points of view and what that means as far as like Jane Austen and Virginia Woolf and James Joyce, Achebe, all these different writers that are sort of shifting around, playing around with the idea that you can like provide a single point of view or a couple points of view or all of the different points of view of all of the characters, right? And so that's really important because that's makes literature and novels different from, say, movies. I mean, there's some crossover with voiceovers and different sort of narrative techniques there, but it really is what makes the art form unique when you compare it to, you know, say, theater or something like that or poetry. Then there's figurative language, so you can start the year with that, where there's all different kinds of metaphors, personification, pathetic fallacy, synecdoche, metonymy, hyperbole, oxymoron, synesthesia, apostrophe, all different sort of ways of saying the thing that can't possibly be true, right? That's the metaphor. And then there's a whole set of terms with poetry, right? You got the different stanzas, like couplets, tercets, quatrains. You got the different feet, iambic, dimeter and tetrameter and pentameter, right? And sort of stress and unstress, and that whole, you know, that's a whole lesson in and of itself. Then you have all the sound techniques that we associate with poetry that appear in novels, but alliteration, consonants, caesura, refrain, enjambment, onomatopoeia, all these things, different things that sort of specifically apply to poetry. And then you have syntax and grammar. You have parallel structure and repetition, chiasmus, anaphora, you know, it's kind of a fancy term for repetition at the beginning of the phrase or sentence. You got all different kinds of just regular things that you're looking out for in grammar that, as far as patterns are concerned, repetition of prepositional phrases, modal auxiliary verbs, you know, the helping verbs, pronouns, conjunctions, punctuation even is really, really important to look at when you're dealing with both poetry and novels. So it's a lot, right? Like I just took you through kind of everything that's important, but I do it at different points in the year. But what I think where students get lost is So here are the techniques. You know, that's kind of overwhelming, like just getting familiar with everything I just said. And then there's, okay, so what? Like, what's the point of that technique? Like, what does that do for the meaning of the text and for your interpretation of the text? And what do you learn about? Right, period. Right, so that's what I'm going to kind of go over, because that's a different story. And I think when students like sort of quote different literary devices in a poem or in a novel, sometimes they just leave it there. You know, there's alliteration here and rhyme here and repetition, parallel structure over here, and they don't really do anything with it. Or there's different, say, things like, oh, it contributes to the tone, or it contributes to the speaker's point of view or perspective. You know, it's not really sinking their teeth in at all. It's just sort of a broad thing about the style, and, you know, it doesn't actually help you understand the thing. And so the thing is, you know, what we're going to get into. And sometimes, you know, we sort of have this conversation when we talk about this, is that sometimes there is no purpose, and that's okay. You know, if you look at a villanelle or a sonnet, usually there is a reason for the rules on all the techniques that are in, say, a sonnet. Do the rhymes always have to sort of have some deeper meaning attached? No. But sometimes a rhyme is very important, and the meanings behind the sort of interpretation of the symbolic quality of the words that rhyme make you sort of compare those words or contrast those ideas and concepts that are in those words that rhyme. So sometimes it has a point. Sometimes it is just for entertainment's sake and to get you to sort of have something that's pleasing to the ear or eye. But most techniques do allow for some sort of meaning-making digging to occur, if you will. They allow us to deep dive instead of swimming around on the surface. So the way that I break it down for my students, I'll try to make this one quick, is basically three different things. The first thing is the literary techniques convey an emotion. And I sometimes will actually put these three things on a piece of paper and hang it in my class. It's like a single 8.5 by 11 sheet, and it's in huge font. So it's just like 1, 2, 3. So if they're sort of thinking, you know, and, you know, interpreting something, they can kind of look at the sheet and be like, okay, so which one of these three things does this technique do? And it sort of just reminds them of what it's capable of and what its purpose is. So the first thing is pretty, they're all pretty simple. One is that it conveys an emotion, right? It typically called tone, right? Which is the emotion of the speaker or the narrator, what they feel, right, about, and then how they express those feelings. They can either just say it, and that's kind of boring, right? Like, I feel sad, boo, you know, like, that's exciting to read, or no. Sometimes that's okay, right? That's language is sort of exploring all these different complicated emotions and getting the emotion itself, you know, but when you're dealing with poetry and this complicated thing that you have to unpack and interpret and sort of raises questions about different things, you want to get it in different ways, and sometimes those different ways help you understand the thing better, than just saying, I am sad, right? That helps you understand, but doesn't get you to the full understanding, the full truth of what they're going through. It's not that simple. And so they show this with metaphors and similes and all these different ways, symbols, where they can sort of indirectly access the thing that the character is feeling. The second thing is to express an idea. So there's an emotion, and then there's an idea. So most literature starts with the introduction of an idea or a concept and then explores it more in greater depth. And it's true that if you look at the first page and last page of a novel, or the first couple lines or a first stanza and the last stanza of a poem, you will see, like, okay, I started here and now I'm here. And what does that mean? Not just I went from feeling this to feeling that, but it has to do with an idea, right? Or a concept. And that the exploration of that idea is typically what a lot of literary techniques will sort of speak to. A theme or an argument is that closes things down, whereas a motif, say something like an idea or a symbol or something that repeats itself, and a typically, you know, ideas sort of find this sort of pattern that develops through a novel. It opens up possibilities rather than just saying, "Here's the thing that I think." You know, you just sort of revisit that concept over and over again. And as you move along in the text, you sort of build on your understanding of the meaning, the greater meaning of that concept. So ideas can start us with something like as simple as a topic, right? So family, imagination, immigration, tradition, joy, race, crime, time is always a good sort of idea to sort of explore, a concept to explore. Art is always a good one. And so those sort of, when you're keeping track of that, like in To the Lighthouse, you have a Lily who's painting this painting, and then at one point she doesn't finish it, and then she comes back to it 10 years later, and it sort of comes to represent herself and her identity and her view of the world and what she's trying to express and what she wants for everybody else to sort of grapple with as far as the spirituality and being and existing in space and time and all these really complicated concepts. And it all revolves around the idea of art, right? So that idea of what art can accomplish, right, is another example. So emotion, idea, and then the third one is it just depicts the reality. So when you're, you know, film director, you want to just recreate it's like the story, right? Like you have the emotion, the idea, and then you have the story itself, the events as they unfold, the place where you are, right? This is where, so you have tone, and the other big thing is mood and atmosphere, right? The setting itself. And of course, these are all ways of access. There's crossover here, right? Because the atmosphere allows you to access the feeling of the character. And usually it's the symbol of the symbols that surround a character will help you understand what they're going through. But just imitating reality, the making of this world that the character is living in is sometimes just that's what the device functions to do. It's to depict all of the details of the situation. So this includes sensory imagery inside of a room or a forest, includes action and dialogue, the rhythm of a line of poetry. We talk about this a lot when we do this stress and unstressed syllables in a line of poetry. The sounds will often correspond to the actual image. You know, we did A Sunflower by William Blake, where the sunflower is growing and the rhythm is rising, falling star. We do, a falling leaf or river, right? All the different sounds that you're supposed to hear, the sounds of the poem, you know, and not just in the letters and the rhymes and different things, but also in the actual rhythm of the poem, you hear those sort of melodies that are all around us in real life. And it's just supposed to really imitate that. You know, this great example is The Great Gatsby, where you're like in this kind of chaotic scene with all this music playing and these people are moving everywhere and everybody's drinking and dancing. And there's just like, you can't even focus on one thing because it's all happening so quickly and there's so many people, so much action. Right? And so the language imitates that chaos by including a lot of commas, or really long winding sentences with lists of different things, right? So those lists function to speak to the reality of the kind of the list-like nature, right, of the many, many different things happening all around Nick. All Quiet, same way. You have this character who's a soldier in the First World War, and there's a bomb here and a plane here, trenches, and somebody saying something over here, and you know, there's no man's land, and you know, there's a lot of different sort of explosions and different things that are like these fragmented realities, and so the language of those in those descriptions imitate that reality, because that's, you just want to make sure that your reader knows what war is like, and that's the objective, is to just tell the story of war, right? And especially for a young person to sort of go through that, right? Invisible Man's the same thing. He's in this boxing arena, one of the first scenes in Battle Royale, he's in the boxing arena, and you get the smoke and this whiskey and a naked woman. You have the electrocution of this carpet, this rug, and they're throwing coins on it. You have all of these incredible details, and you realize that race is like this show for the successful white businessmen who are putting this on. They're basically paying people a little bit of money to put this show on for them. Like, this is what I think of as race, right? So all of those, that atmosphere and that mood of that space allows you to understand this bigger concept, but it is to just allow you to really understand how corrupt the whole thing is, and so all the details sort of speak to all of that. So that's the sort of power of a symbol, is that it's just a bottle of whiskey, it's just a cigar, right? But they sort of represent things. I said a tuxedo. A lot of the guys are wearing like shirts and ties and suits and tuxedos, and so those all symbolize status and power and all those different things. So it could just be fabric, you know, but it also, and tobacco, but it represents way more than that as far as, you know, a greater understanding of that scene. These details accurately conjure up an imaginary reality with all of its sounds and smells, right? So it's almost like a virtual, literary techniques allow for this kind of virtual, right, this sort of fabricated reality, which I know is like an oxymoron in and of itself, but that's what it's doing. I remember in Emma by Jane Austen, which I still haven't decided to teach since the pandemic because I feel like it's just a lot to handle. So maybe next year. But I do feel like my students this year are completely back on the pre-pandemic space and mentality that we were in before, or they're just like really care about things and are willing to engage in conversations. So that's really, really nice to experience that again. And my students did the best they could. I don't want to sort of badmouth my students from the last few years because it was a lot. We were really, really remote at times. And even when we went back in person, I remember having like two kids in class and that kind of thing. They did their best. But yeah, it's nice to kind of have a little bit of a better rhythm going again. But either way, there's a moment in Emma where they're walking through the countryside and there's a lot of people in the party and they're about to split up and go in different directions. But while they're all together, they're sort of just winding and twisting and turning. And there's a lot of like repetition and parallel structure and different punctuation that imitates that sort of that's winding around, like you feel like you're sort of bouncing around in the sentence as it unfolds. And there's another moment makes me think of that and like Great Expectations at the end of the first book. He like wants to leave Kent, his hometown. He's a young kid, but he's also excited to go to London, this big city with opportunities. And he's going to be a gentleman and he's got a suit on. So he wants to get out of there and really experience life beyond the forge and what the reality that Joe and Mrs. Joe have provided him with as a child. And he gets a little slice of, you know, what it means to be rich with Havisham and Estella. So he's like, you know, really wants to get out of there, but he also loves Joe and values what he's done for him. And he's like sort of nervous and scared. And so throughout the whole thing, it's that, right? He's constantly pausing and stopping, like thinking he should go back. And so there's a ton of punctuation and conjunctions that really slow down the narration. And it's an imitation of reality. It's like that's literally physically what he's doing is stopping before he goes to London. And that's literally what the language is doing with all these sort of breaks in the sentence. So you get to really feel what he's going through by like all these things kind of apply there, right? The idea of leaving and then the adventure and the journey, and then you have the reality of stopping and starting, and then the emotion and that sort of mixed feelings that he has about being hopeful and full of joy, but also sad that he's leaving. Right, so you get all of that in that passage, and that's like, right. So I'm, you know, even one single passage can accomplish, or any particular technique can kind of maybe accomplish all three at the same time. So not to sort of break them up in that way. But techniques can also create patterns that help unfold a theme or show the transformation of a character, right? So there's obviously many, many, many other things that techniques do. You know, they could show the logical development of a thought or a decision, say, or closely examine the beauty and spirit of an image, like sort of reminds me of Elizabeth Bishop, you know, the poem The Fish. I'm a big Elizabeth Bishop fan. And so you're like really getting that essence, you know, to get the essence of something is what literary techniques do, because you can't get the essence of something by just stating facts about it, right? You got to do a little bit more than that to get the power of it. Literary techniques help the reader become immersed in a moment or a person and create pleasing melodies that exist in the sounds that surround us in real life, like something simple like walking or chewing or dribbling a basketball. Students study the impact of literary language, and as a consequence, they acquire the ability themselves to write and speak creatively and conjure up those transformative worlds on their own. So that's always the end objective, is to not just be good readers, but to be creative writers, right? Writers that see somebody else use these techniques and then they can go do it themselves, right? So that's the end objective. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Again, if you liked listening, if you like listening to my podcast, please, please, please leave me a review so that I can get more word out about this. And if you want to be really crazy, you can donate to the podcast as well. Thank you for listening.